How did the hammerhead shark do on his test? He nailed it. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Starting Sustainability. I am your host, Kaylin Chenoweth, and this is episode 159, round two for Shark Month. First, we're going to do catching up with Kaylin. Holy moly, time change sucks. I really, really, really hate time change. Everybody in our household has been cranky all week long, and it is only Wednesday. This needs to end ASAP. Currently, I'm in a new setup. We're going to test it out this episode. I am at the Airbnb that I'm at every week, and usually I sit on the floor in the living room because there's carpet everywhere, and then there's a big sofa with lots of throw pillows, and I kind of pile those all around me because the carpet and the pillows and the couch all help absorb sound, so it's not so echoey, so you kind of get a more pure sound. However, my hips are on fire, so I set up at a little desk area and grabbed a chair from the kitchen table, but the chairs are all wicker. I don't know if you can hear that. That's me fidgeting in the chair. It makes a lot of noise. This is a very, very noisy chair. I'm going to try to hold still as much as possible, but I apologize in advance if you hear some weird creaking in the background. It's just my butt on this chair. In the last episode, I had discovered the Bible app and the Bible Recap podcast. There was a whole lot of interest in that, which is really cool to me. I will now divulge a little bit more details about it and kind of help explain it, because I just touched on it briefly before because I was just saying, hey, this is what I'm into. And it's really kind of cool, and I'm glad to see that a lot of people are interested in it. So to recap, you would download the Bible app. And on the Bible app, there's different plans. And so you would search for the Bible Recap plan. That's the plan that you would select. And you would select, you know, I'm recording on March 13th. Happy Registered Dietitians Day, by the way, March 13th. It is National Registered Dietitian Nutritionist Day. I know there are a handful that listen to the podcast, so happy RDN Day to everybody. I also took a moment to celebrate myself. I indulged in some lemon cookies, because that's what every dietitian does when it's time to celebrate. We eat cookies, right? Don't worry, I had a hummus veggie plate for lunch, so it's all balanced and good. Anyways, so back to the Bible recap. I really got distracted there. I just wanted to celebrate. Back to the Bible recap. So you download the Bible app. You follow the Bible recap plan. In there, it'll keep track of what day you're on, day 1, 2, 3, 4. And I'm already behind, so it's all right if you are too, if you're not able to do it every single day. It's highly encouraged to do it every single day. In my world, that's not a reality, because trust me, I keep trying. It's just a challenge, but that's okay. You pull it up, you read the passage, the devotional, and then you will listen to the podcast that corresponds to it. So you'd have to go into your podcast player and find the Bible Recap podcast, and you would listen to the podcast episode that correlates to it, day 1, day 2, day 3. They're labeled, so it's easy to find the ones that correlate to it. So in the Bible Recap podcast, it's like 8 minutes or less. It's real brief and quick. It just gives a nice summary of what you just read with a little bit of explanation. It will give you a handful of questions to help you think and get your thought processes going to reflect on throughout the day and develop your relationship with God, which is what it's designed to do. But if you are very curious and you have some questions that you want to get answered, then you can check out the show notes of the Bible Recap podcast. So click in their show notes, and then it will give you links to other things, including the Bible Project, which I mentioned a long time ago. There are videos, YouTube videos of the Bible Project that give a lot more in-depth discussion. And there's also the Bible Project podcast, and it will give links to that, that will give a much more in-depth discussion of what you just read from the Bible Recap. Hopefully you're not mixing all these up. But in the end, it all ties together really, really well. You can make it as short and simple as you want, keeping it about 20 minutes a day by just reading the devotional and listening to the Bible Recap podcast. You can also get a lot more out of it by watching the video or listening to the podcast by the Bible Project, but it will be like a good full hour and a half. So if you have that kind of time every day, awesome. But if not, that's fine too. It's just really a cool thing to see all of these different things that interested me and caught my attention, and now I'm starting to see them all connect together, which I found really awesome. I just want to explain that process to you. In a previous episode, I don't know if it was the last one or two ago, I don't know. I'm sleep deprived. Thank you, daylight savings. Anyways, so I did mention that I wanted to learn how to sing and that I have been singing, following YouTube videos and strengthening my voice and practicing 2 weekends ago. So I recorded the episode on Wednesday and then it was like 3 days later, it was my great big debut at church. Woo! That means that Sunday, the kids stayed home with Channing so I could go to church early and practice the song that I had been singing for the past month. This was the first time I had sang a song as a solo in front of a group of people. It was a little bit of a big deal, and I was a bit nervous, which is why I wanted to get there early. The song that I picked was You Say by Lauren Daigle. If you haven't heard of it, it's actually a very beautiful song. The kids have listened to me sing this song in the car every day, twice a day, for the past month. They are really in tune to this song. So I got to church. I got there early to practice, but the gentleman who was in charge of all the audio stuff, he was in the adult Bible study class that happens right before church. Therefore, me getting there early did absolutely no good. I was not able to do a sound check or a practice run. Therefore, I just went down to the basement and found a bathroom and practiced in there. That was the best I could do. I did some warm-ups and then I ran through the song twice and thought, good enough, we're gonna have to go with that. And we're just gonna put it in God's hands and fate at this moment in time and just strongly believe that this is gonna be amazing with no problems whatsoever. So if you're thinking that I jinxed myself, you would be correct. Church starts and we go about our service and then it's my turn to get up there and sing the song. Cool, I get up there, I start singing on the mic. And it's Communion Sunday, so they have this big table with the bread and the grape juice. We do grape juice at our church, kind of in the way. So I had to step down off of the stage area. Our stage area is very tiny, like maybe the size of 2 regular couches. Pretty tiny, and there's a big table in the middle of it. So I just kind of step down onto the floor. I start singing, and all of a sudden there's this humming noise. And then the humming noise is getting louder and louder. And I'm kind of like walking around trying to figure out where to go, where to position myself. And it's just getting louder and louder. And I didn't know what to do. So I'm looking out at the crowd and one person, well, because of this weird noise, I instantly pulled the mic away. And I'm looking out at the crowd and one person is like motioning me to put the microphone back up to my mouth so they can hear. And I'm looking out and another person is like, walk this way, and is pointing. So I took a few steps to the side and we kind of got the humming noise to die down. There was another mic that was left on the stage and I ended up getting too close to it. I didn't know it at the time. I was just in the moment like, okay, I'm trying to sing and I've got this weird humming noise going on. And because of the humming noise, my voice matched that, and so that threw me off key because I'm very much a by ear person. I hear and I sing it. I can read music, but if I just look at notes on the music, I can't tell you what they sound like. But if you hit the note on the piano, I can match it. I do it by ear quite a bit. I sing by ear. When I took piano lessons, I always played by ear. I always had to hear the song first so I knew what it was supposed to sound like, which can be a good talent, but in this case was not a good thing because it threw me off and I was definitely out of tune for a little bit. So then I did the trick where you plug your ears so you can hear your own voice and I can hear the music and I can match it back up and get back on key, back in tune. Okay, doing all right. And then all of a sudden the mic just cut out. It just went dead. And I thought, great. So now what do? I will belt it loud so people can hear me. And also I want to point out that as much as I practice and I strengthen my voice, when you get up on stage and your heart rate is pounding really fast and you instantly get cotton mouth. I mean, I had water. I immediately took a drink of water right before I walked up to the stage. But within about 2.3 seconds, my mouth completely dried out. And now I'm trying to sing. Your range gets shortened when you are completely dry in your mouth, when you have cotton mouth. So I couldn't quite hit the high notes and I definitely couldn't hit the low notes. The low notes were already a little bit of a stretch for me, but I'd practice and practice and got to where I could do it. But then while I'm up there in front of everybody singing, I was trying to hit the low notes and just air came out. I couldn't even hit them. And I was so embarrassed. Really, I was mortified. I finished the song. I walked back. People were very polite and they clapped and they said, good job. You did great. And I just sat there and all I wanted to do was get out of church. I just wanted to leave the sanctuary and go disappear. I was so embarrassed. Oh, and I forgot to mention that my mom and dad were there, plus both my sisters and their husbands, all in support, which I really, really do appreciate. That was very nice of them to come. That was really cool because I didn't ask them to do that. So that was very nice of them. And I was just really bummed. All the work that I had done for a month, for an entire month, twice a day, singing the song, learning the song, practicing, warming up, strengthening my voice. Like, I did all that work and it just flopped. It was very disheartening. Eventually I came home and of course the kids rushed up to me and they wanted to know how mama's singing was. And I told them the truth. I said, oh, you know, some things went wrong. And I said, I'm really sad because I worked really, really hard and some of the technical issues kind of ruined it. But it's okay. And I still learned how to sing and, you know, I will sing another song another day. And of course, the kids were super sweet and supportive. They gave me hugs and they told me how beautiful my voice was and how they loved my song, which was very nice of them. That made me feel better. But all day long, it really did eat at me. It took me a long time to kind of shake it off. In fact, it took until about 9 o'clock that night when I finally got the idea to go onto YouTube and search and find our church's live stream and watch myself perform because I wanted to see just how bad it was. I'm watching the video, and in the video, I see myself stand up. I see myself start singing. You can't even hear the humming noise at all in the video. So all of a sudden, I'm just pulling the mic away. Nobody knows what happens. I walk around, and then the mic comes back up. In total, I sing 4 lines, and then the microphone cut dead. And you couldn't hear me at all. Nobody could hear me. It was, I am there and you can see my mouth moving and you can hear the music because it was a karaoke style song. So it was just the instrumental. I had to do all the words, but you can hear all the instrumental and you can see me singing, but you can't hear anything. So I guess in the end, it really wasn't that embarrassing. Like nobody could hear me not hit the notes. Nobody could hear me get off key. Nobody could hear me at all. So it was just disappointing that I also worked so hard for nobody to hear me. but at least the embarrassment was remediated at that point, and I was finally able to calm down and shake it off and go to sleep. And now I'm going to share a parenting moment. Like I said, I went to church, I came home. So this is just a half a day. This is what happens in half of a day. I came home. Channing left to go kayaking with my brother-in-law. My sister Dawn came over. She toured the RV and then played with the kids on the trampoline. We all did. We all played with the kids on the trampoline. We went for a walk around the pond that's in our backyard. She gave the boys really cool bike helmets, previously loved, just fine by me. It was a dinosaur bike helmet and BB-8. Corbin picked the dinosaur one, which is a bit small on his head, but still loves it to death. And Colt picked the BB-8 and has no idea what Star Wars is or what BB-8 is. He just asks, is this an astronaut helmet? Yes, it is, buddy. It's an astronaut helmet. Eventually, Dawn took off. The kids and I then played with bikes and chalk outside because it was just absolutely gorgeous weather. Just so nice. It's been months since we've had really nice weather. When we were playing with the chalk, we drew a great big rocket ship on the driveway. We went to outer space. Then we came inside for a little bit and we did carpet cleaning in the boys' room because it reeked of Ruger's pee. There was one night where he ended up peeing in their closet. I don't know why. I guess just because he's old. He doesn't normally have accidents in the house, but he did and their room stinked. We did the carpet cleaning. Well, it's been a couple days and I'll tell you what, it didn't work, still smells. So apparently I get to do some more carpet cleaning. They enjoyed helping with the carpet cleaner, so that was quite a task. Well, a job that would normally take 5 minutes took 25 minutes because I had help. And then we went back outside and planted a garden. That's right, it's garden planting season. We took some potatoes and cut them up and put them in. So I'm going to try growing potatoes again this year. Very excited. I'm sure you guys are all on edge to hear all about the potatoes all summer long. I'm just kidding. Yes, let me tell you, gardening with children is quite an adventure because I could only find one hand shovel. So the boys and I all had to share the one hand shovel with a whole lot of whining. Oh my gosh, so much whining. They're driving me nuts. I finally went and got another shovel. It was a great big one that you would like dig a hole to plant a tree in, like a full grown tree. It was a big shovel. That's fine. Worked for them. Colt used that to dig in the garden while I was planting stuff. And turns out Colt was using that to dig in the garden and dump all the dirt onto the grass. I said, oh great, this is awesome gardening dirt. I put all the chicken compost and leaves and straw like last year at the end of fall. So it sat all winter long and could kind of compost a little bit, get lots of nutrients in the garden. And now you're just digging it all up and shoving it in the grass. I was like, stop, the dirt has to stay in the garden beds. Stop putting it in the grass. You're kind of undoing all my hard work, but that's fine. It's great family bonding time. While we're doing this, Hazley is amusing herself by playing with the seed packets. Fine girl, have found the seed packets. What harm could she do? Oh, she ripped them open and dumped a lot of the seeds straight into the grass. Suddenly my garden got a lot smaller because I didn't have half the stuff to plant anymore. That's okay. That's fine. The packets that I was able to save were planted by me and the boys, and that means that the ones I planted were evenly dispersed. And Colt dumped an entire packet of spinach all in a one square inch area. So we're going to have a whole lot of spinach in that one little tiny spot. And then I let the boys water the garden, and they took turns doing this. And when it was Colt's turn to water, Corbin would pinch the hose and stop the water. And then Colt would stare down the empty hose, and Corbin would let go, and the water would shoot up and splash Colt in the face. Which, believe it or not, both boys found absolutely hilarious, because I definitely thought Colt was going to have a meltdown. It was a nice day outside, but it was like in the 60s. It wasn't exactly swimming weather. Colt did end up getting really pretty wet and asked if he could go change his clothes. Yes, kid, you can go change your clothes. I'm not going to make you stay in sopping wet clothes outside. It's warm, but it's not that warm. Colt left. Corbin and Hazley and I played baseball for a short little bit. And then Colt comes back and he's running around in his swim trunks and he says, let's go swimming. I want to go swimming. I thought, it's awfully cold out here. I said, where are you going to go swimming? Because you can't go in the pond. Oh, how about the pool? Well, the pool's not set up, and I'm pretty sure we're not going to set it up this year because that was way too much work last year. So we did find an old kiddie pool, and well, it wasn't even a kiddie pool. It's actually an old sandbox, but we put water in that and turned it into a tiny little kiddie pool and brought out some toys so he could play in that. I left to go start on dinner, and I kept looking out the window to check on the boys, and Colt is playing in the kiddie pool, pretending to go fishing, and I look around. Oh, where's Corbin? There he is. Corbin is jumping on the trampoline with the water hose on, going everywhere, swinging around his head, just like dancing under this. He is the sprinkler system, dancing underneath all the water falling down on him, just having the time of his life. And I thought, wow, we have not had a family day like this in a super long time. Literally since the weather has been so cold and crummy, because we don't hang outside. And when we hang out inside, we can do short little things like playing one game or a small round of hide and go seek. But it ultimately always ends up being chores, because when you are cramped inside the house all the time, you make the mess inside the house and now you have to clean up the mess. And when you have nice weather and you can go outside and we have a big giant backyard, yeah, make a mess out there, leave the house alone, and now I don't have to clean it. If you're going to have lots of kids, live somewhere where it's warm all the time and have a big, gigantic backyard. I did touch base on Ruger just a little bit. I'll go into some more detail. Unfortunately, for the past few days, Ruger's had some vomiting and diarrhea. We did go to the vet, and we spent a lot of money on some stupid expensive medicine. Hopefully it works. He's been out for 2 days now and seems to be all right. However, over the past week, he has pooped and or puked in every single room. And most of our rooms are carpeted, so that sucks. Including the boys' room, where I'd already done carpet cleaning that didn't work. So now we're carpet cleaning again because there are poop stains all over. And Ruger threw up on our bed. Don't worry, it was my side of the bed. So Channing didn't care. So I got to clean that up too. It's great having a senior dog. It's really heartbreaking because he's sick. He gets sick easily. He's riddled with arthritis. It's very hard for him to hop up on the bed or to climb into a car, which is probably why he stayed on the bed. Normally, he gets down out of the bed, and I can hear him. If you've got a dog, you know that nothing gets you out of bed faster. Then you start hearing that noise, and you make a mad dash to the back door to let the dog out so they can puke outside. Hopefully, we're able to get him feeling better soon. And the last little bit of catching up with Kaylin, I wanted to do a little book update. I did read The 5 Love Languages of Children. I think I shared that before. I finished that up and have implemented some of it. I think it's kind of helping, although it does say, like, this is for children 5 and older. And I said, oh, cool. So my kids are all 5 and under. So we'll try it, but I'm not going to hold my breath too much on it. But I do have some tools in my toolbox for when the kids get a little bit older on how to express love to them in their love language to keep them feeling good and keeping their love tanks full, basically. Now I've checked out a couple of new books. The first one is Make Your Bed, and, oh shoot, it's by McRaven. I don't remember his first name. Somebody McRaven. I'm so sorry. But he was in the Navy SEALs, so he's a pretty important guy. It's very short. It's just kind of a little self-help motivational book on basically how to take charge of your day and how to change your life. All right, so I've started that about halfway through it. And I also got a book called Have a New Kid by Friday, and that's by Dr. Kevin Lamar. I am halfway through Monday. The chapters are, here's the intro, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, so on. So I read the intro and I'm halfway through Monday. Today is Wednesday. So clearly falling behind again. I just keep filling up my plate. I have to do a daily Bible verse. I have to read all these books each day. I have to read so many pages. I'm still trying to study for my HR exam. That's really fallen to the wayside. I've really got to get back onto that. Don't tell my boss. But anyways, so that's where I'm at in reading. And I just was reflecting, and I thought it was so interesting how when I was in college, I think I read maybe a book a year for leisure because I'd spend so much time studying all day long that when I was done studying, the last thing I wanted to do was read any type of text at all. I would just veg out on maybe one or two TV shows and pass out to sleep. Out of college, I did start reading a whole bunch more, a lot of fun adventure books, a lot of World War II, historical romance, a real big wide variety. Basically, if it was in the New York Times top sellers list, like I would grab it and check it out. It was fun. It was a lot of fun reading. Now I'm a married woman with 3 kids. And so I'm reading self-help books, looking at books that help with your relationships, help keep them going, keep them strong. How to be a parent. Oh, and since I'm a career woman, I've also been reading a lot of HR-related books, too. It's very different. It is quite interesting how the phases of your life determine what you read in books. And since reading each day tends to be a little bit of a struggle, I don't read nearly as much as I want to, but I am on the go all the time, and I listen to podcasts. A lot. And that is how I learned all about sharks. And so this leads us into part 2 of Shark Month. The source for today is My Favorite Murder, episode 412. And that's where I got pretty much all of my information. To recap, in the last episode, we talked about all of the science behind shark attacks and how that started after a terrible shark incident in the U.S. Navy in World War II. Previously, I gave a brief description about it, but today we're going to go over all of the details. The naval ship that ended up sinking was the USS Indianapolis. So this ship launched on November 7th, 1931, and was commissioned on November 15th, 1932. It's about a year later. The USS Indianapolis is one of just 2 U.S. Naval Portland-class heavy cruisers. I have no idea what that means. I'm not a ship person. I don't know the differences in ships. I barely know the differences in cars. But apparently that means it's a very large warship that is designed to travel long distances at high speed. After the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941, the USS Indianapolis officially joined the war effort. She contributes to multiple, that's right, she, because for some reason ships are females. And so she, the ship, contributes to multiple campaigns over the course of the next 4 years, including protecting U.S. aircraft carriers near New Guinea. That was in March 1942, sinking an enemy ship belonging to Japan in January 1943, and serving as the flagship for Admiral Spruance during the Battle of Okinawa in 1945. But the USS Indianapolis's most consequential contribution to World War II would come on July 26, 1945. That's basically near the end of the war, and it was a super top secret mission. It was an overseas delivery of the core components of Little Boy. If you don't know what Little Boy is, that is the atomic bomb that was headed for Hiroshima. On March 31st, 1945, the USS Indianapolis did sustain a kamikaze hit near Okinawa, and that in turn lands it at the Navy Yard on Mare Island in Vallejo, California. She's there to get repaired, basically, and it will take until about mid-July 1945 before she's fully repaired. The ship's captain is Captain Charles B. McVeigh, the third. And he has a crew of 1,195 sailors, so almost 1,200 sailors. I want to tell you a little bit about Captain McVeigh. He is a native of Pennsylvania, and he's from a Navy legacy family. McVeigh graduated from the United States Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland in 1920, and he worked in Washington, D.C., serving as the chairman of the Joint Intelligence Committee of the Combined Chiefs of Staff, which is the highest military intelligence unit. They make all wartime policy decisions during World War II. He was also the recipient of a Silver Star Award. This is the third highest military award for bravery. This guy is very smart and well-educated, and he's top-notch. That's what he is. He's a good captain to have on your ship. On July 12, 1945, Captain McVeigh gets word that the Indianapolis is going to be used for this top-secret mission once it's fully repaired. The mission is so secret that not even Captain McVeigh knows what it is. All he knows is that he is going to be given some materials that are to be delivered to Tinian, one of the northern Mariana Islands just north of Guam. On July 15, 1945, the USS Indianapolis receives the materials, and then the next day, July 16th, it sets sail, and it's completely unaware of the cargo on board, which is the making of the atomic bomb. The ship reaches the destination on the morning of Thursday, July 26, and successfully delivers the cargo. The ship then makes a short trip south to Guam, arriving the next day, and they refuel and stock up on ammunition and other supplies. Then on Saturday, July 28, 1945, the USS Indianapolis makes a straight shot west to Leyte, which is a province in the Philippines. The journey should take them 3 days, so they are projected to arrive on July 31st, 1945. So far, everything has gone a little too smoothly. As the ship is making its trip to Leyte, there is a looming threat that lurks beneath the waters, and it's watching them. It's a Japanese submarine I-58. And in the middle of the night, on July 29th, 1945, the sonar man aboard the submarine is patrolling the Philippine Sea when he picks up on a strange sound coming from about 6 miles away. He hears the rattling of dishes and realizes it's from a ship's gallery. I did not realize how good sonar was. And this is back in the 1940s. Like, it must be absolutely insane today on how accurate it is. But the fact that they could hear dishes 6 miles away and from that gather, there's a ship headed this way. Like, that blows my mind. That's crazy. In the submarine, they realize it's a ship. The submarine commander is Commander Machisura Hashimoto. And the commander orders his crew to stalk the vessel. And once they get close enough, they identify it as an enemy ship. And then moments later, at 12:04 a.m. on July 30th, 1945, the commander orders his crew to fire 6 torpedoes at the USS Indianapolis. The good news is, Only two torpedoes hit the mark. The bad news is, it does some pretty serious damage. The missiles hit the middle of the vessel near the ship's fuel tank, causing an explosion that kills all the power. People on board are unable to see in the darkness, but they can hear the water seeping in and feel it rising beneath their feet. It was an immediate evacuation. Captain McVeigh is trying to assess the damage, but the ship is rapidly sinking and the communication systems are also not working. He can't really tell what is going on, so he has his men try and send out distress signals, but ultimately it's of no use. At this point, Captain McVeigh orders the crew to abandon ship and he stays on board himself until the last possible moment to make sure as many people as possible are evacuated. It only took 15 minutes for the massive heavy cruiser to be completely swallowed up by the sea. And with it, it takes roughly 300 men. That leaves the remaining 895 sailors adrift in the water. The survivors hang on to anything and everything at their disposal. Life vests, there's some rafts, there's lots of debris that they use to help them float. Ordinarily, the Navy tracks the position of all vessels at sea so they can react in times of distress. But because the USS Indianapolis was conducting top secret work, the vessel wasn't tracked. And they also had not been granted an escort, which McVeigh had asked for. They said no because they didn't want to draw attention to the fact that this was an important vessel. What this means is that no one is coming for the rescue. The 895 stranded sailors, they drift apart into two large groups. The first group, which is including Captain McVeigh, is situated northeast of the wreck, just outside the grasp of a strong current, and they luckily have rafts to save them from having to tread water and being submerged, but they are still left with very little food and clean water. The second group is carried southwest by the current about 7 to 10 miles away from Captain McVeigh's group, and they're protected by nothing but their life vests. They don't have rafts, debris, nothing. Just really cold water and open sea, which has to be absolutely terrifying. Even more bad news. The life vests are only meant to stay inflated for 64 hours. They're not long-term. It's just for emergencies, which is what this is. But nobody's coming. 64 hours is not enough. It's literally just a matter of time before the vests give way. Some of the sailors don't even make it past the first day. They either succumb to injuries that they sustained during the wreck, or they lose their minds due to the brutal conditions of bobbing up and down at sea and having absolutely no hope. All they have is despair. And that can really mess with your head. Some men purposefully slip out of their vests and just sink away into the water. Other survivors do grab those vests to help keep themselves afloat, which is a smart move. The conditions are so bad, groups of men are hallucinating and they're seeing collectively as a group that the ship did not sink. It's right over here. We're going to swim over here. Oh, this milk and tomato juice, it's so delicious, and it doesn't exist. It's not there. They're just hallucinating. The conditions are so bad, and every passing moment, the air pressure from the life vest decreases. If a sailor is not in a life vest, that means they have to actively keep swimming non-stop, which is very exhausting. And they rotate, taking turns and keeping watch over each other and letting each other sleep. I mean, even those who are in life vests, the moment that they fall asleep, if their face falls forward, they're putting their face in salt water and put themselves at risk of drowning. It's just so much energy, so exhausting. I want to point out that I was on the swim team, and there was one practice where we all had to be in the deep end treading water and watching a movie. I mean, after 1 hour, you are exhausted from treading water. These men had to do it for 4 days. 4 days. They couldn't just climb out of the pool and take a nap. They couldn't just get fresh water and rehydrate and get electrolytes in or get their power protein bar. Like, they had nothing. The only thing they had was true grit and determination. At this point, sailors are fighting starvation and exhaustion, and the only thing that they have going for them is sheer willpower. That's really it. And then another danger approaches, and it's your worst nightmare. The men spot dorsal fins emerging from the water's surface, and it's encircling the group. That's right. It's sharks. That's what makes this story so much worse. One sailor would report, you would just look, and then you'd see the life jacket go under the water. That's it. Basically, you're just watching a guy, and the person gets pulled under just like that. Bloodied remains of fellow sailors would then bob to the surface. The sharks would come and go and come and go, and every time they came, they would just pick men off. Another sailor reports, you would just hear blood-curdling screams echoing off from the distance. And it was either a sailor being overcome by delirium, starvation, or shark attack. Finally, 4 days later, that's four 24-hour periods. 96 hours later, at about 10:25 a.m. on August 2nd, 1945, there's a 24-year-old U.S. pilot named Lieutenant Wilbur, went by Chuck, Gwen, so Lieutenant Gwen. He's flying over the area, conducting a search and reconnaissance mission when he spots something in the water. And it's not the enemy ships that he's been looking for. But rather, it was the U.S. military personnel floating in several groups across roughly 200-mile span of ocean. So he's not even looking for them. Nobody is looking for them. He's just looking for enemy ships and happens to stumble upon all of his fellow military personnel barely surviving. The good news is, Lieutenant Gwynn is able to radio in and says that there are lots of men in the water and he's asking for backup. Lieutenant Gwen is unable to fly his aircraft low enough for rescue, but he is able to send the communication, and his base sends a second pilot, who is Lieutenant Adrian Marks, who is able to come out and flag the incident for another nearby ship, the USS Cecil Doyle, who then also assists in the whole rescue mission. Adrian Marks is able to land, and he's able to rescue 56 men to safety. Hours later, the USS Cecil Doyle finally shows up. Look, it takes a long time to turn a big giant ship around and reroute them, but they are able to finish the job. It takes a full 24 hours to pull the remaining survivors out of the water. Imagine that. You're like, yay, we're getting rescued. I still have to wait 24 hours to get out of this water. How freaking miserable. But they do it. Everybody gets out. And they are in really rough shape. Their tongues are super swollen from dehydration and saltwater poisoning. Some require surgery and others require heavy antibiotic doses to avoid having their shark bites and other wounds infected. I don't know if you caught that. They're shark bites. That means some of the men were just bitten by a shark and then the shark left, like didn't eat or kill the person. We're just going to inflict massive pain and then leave. And now you're bleeding everywhere, making the situation so much worse. Like, oh my gosh, how terrifying. I completely understand if these men have PTSD. Like, I almost expect it at this point. This is absolutely a horror of a story. The men are so weak from treading water for 4 days at this point that they can barely sit up on their own. They definitely cannot stand. And many of the men have lost anywhere from 20 to 25 pounds in a matter of 3.5 to 4 days. That's crazy. That's because the salt water, I don't know if you guys remember osmosis, but water follows solute is a saying of osmosis. So when you're surrounded by super salty water, it's literally pulling water out of your body, dehydrating you even faster. Like, you're not even able to drink water for 3 days and you're surrounded by salt water that's only pulling it out, and you're nonstop moving. That's a lot of calories that you're burning. It's absolutely grueling what these men had to go through. Let's look at the survivors. So the original crew was 1,195 men. And when all is said and done, the people who got pulled out of the water and are still alive is 316. That's basically a 1 in 4 chance of survival. Okay, the good news is the men have been rescued. Not very many of them, but they've been rescued. And now it's time for the Navy to lay blame. Whose fault is this? Well, let's take a look at the facts here. The Navy made a lot of mistakes. So they denied Captain McVeigh the escort that he wanted through enemy waters. And the Navy leadership also denied ever receiving a distress signal from the Indianapolis, despite reports from individual servicemen saying that they did. So they did receive distress signals, and nothing was done about it. And even though the ship wasn't formally being tracked by the Navy, they did know that the Indianapolis was scheduled to arrive in Leyte on July 31st. Basically, they knew it was starting here and going there from this day to that day. And then the day came and passed, and nobody searched. No questions were asked. A gigantic naval ship did not arrive, and nobody noticed this. Really, the most disappointing heartbreak of all is that the Navy knew through a top secret code breaking program that there were enemy submarines positioned along the Indianapolis's route, and that knowledge never appeared on the intelligence report that Captain McVeigh received on board. The war finally ends, America gets the victory, and Navy officials need to protect the U.S. military's image, so they cover their tracks as much as possible, and they find themselves a scapegoat. Guess who the scapegoat is? It's Captain McVeigh. Doesn't that make you want to vomit just a little bit? It's about to get worse. Shortly after he is rescued, Captain Charles McVeigh is court-martialed on 2 counts. Failing to order his men to abandon ship and hazarding the ship, which is basically putting the ship in harm's way. The first charge doesn't stick because the Indianapolis went down so quickly, and the only accounts from other sailors is that Captain McVeigh did everything possible to get his men off the ship. That one doesn't stick. The second charge, however, is hammered in by prosecutors. They argue that Captain McVeigh was ordered to steer his ship in a zigzag pattern to avoid getting hit by torpedoes. Listen, as a person who lived in Florida for 4 years, that is the advice that you receive if you encounter an alligator. Run away in a zigzag pattern. To me, that is just silly. It's a silly argument that is worthless. But anyways, the prosecutors basically said, we told you to do that with the ship. We told you to do a zigzag pattern to avoid enemy fire, and you didn't do it. Therefore, you put your entire crew in jeopardy. And to prove their point, the prosecutors brought in a surprise witness. It was Commander Mochishira Hashimoto. That's the captain of the submarine who took down the Indianapolis. They called him in as a witness. That's messed up. In his testimony, Commander Hashimoto confirms the prosecutor's argument that Captain McVeigh had not been zigzagging, but also undercuts the prosecutor's entire argument by stating that the zigzagging actually wouldn't have made a difference at all. The ship was entirely defenseless, and changing its sailing pattern wouldn't have changed the way that Hashimoto fired the missile, and it wouldn't have helped the ship avoid fire. In his own testimony, Captain McVeigh also owns up to the fact that he did not zigzag, but said that he wasn't definitively instructed to do so. He was told to zigzag at his discretion, weather permitting. Let's face it, the real crime here was really the Navy's failure to alert Captain McVeigh about the actual presence of enemy submarines on his route, and a lot of other failures as well. Unfortunately, Captain McVeigh is found guilty of hazarding his ship. Up to this point, he is the only captain in the history of the U.S. Navy to be court-martialed for the sinking of a ship during wartime. The conviction doesn't come with any jail time, but it does drastically reduce his rank, destroy his reputation, and ruin his lauded military career. By that point, in 1949, Captain McVeigh retires from military service without his reputation making a recovery. The surviving members of his crew find it completely unfair that McVeigh has been forced to shoulder the blame for the sinking of the Indianapolis. Many do praise him as a hero for doing what he could do to save the crew, but many others take his conviction at face value and hold him responsible for the loss of their loved ones. For years, letters pour into McVeigh's mailbox from family members of fallen crew members shaming him for failing to protect their sons. That sentence broke my heart. In 1960, a surviving crew member named Giles McCoy tries to petition the Navy to reverse McVeigh's conviction. It doesn't work. Unfortunately, the guilt becomes too much for Captain McVeigh to bear, and on November 6th, 1968, at the age of 70, Captain Charles Butler McVeigh III takes his own life. 28 years later, in 1996, there is a sixth grader named Hunter Scott from Pensacola, Florida, who chooses to research the USS Indianapolis sinking as part of a school project. This sixth grader conducts 150 survivor interviews and reviews as many as 800 documents related to this incident. This gains traction, and Hunter's school project raises enough awareness to earn Congress's attention. And in a joint effort of the surviving crew members and Captain McVeigh's sons, named Kimo and Charles, and Senator Robert Smith of New Hampshire, agrees to support them and introduces a resolution to exonerate Captain McVeigh. The chairman of the Senate Armed Forces Committee and former Navy Secretary Senator John Warner of Virginia, wow, that is a super long title, this guy, who's important, he refuses to bring the resolution to the Senate floor for a vote. Boo on him. This does stall their efforts, but they got a trick up their sleeve. Guess who's back? That's right. Machishira Hashimoto appears once again to make one final contribution to clearing McVeigh's name. He writes Senator Warren, because I'm not reading that great big long title again, but he writes the villain in this story. Actually, there's lots of villains, but he writes this guy that we're not a fan of, a letter saying, quote, "Our peoples have forgiven each other for that terrible war and its consequences. Perhaps it's time your peoples forgive Captain McVeigh for the humiliation of his unjust conviction," end quote. Wow. That was very powerful, and it worked. Captain McVeigh was exonerated. It was voted on, passed, and then signed by President Bill Clinton on October 12, 2000. 13 days later, on October 25th, 2000, Hashimoto passes away. Isn't that, that's unbelievable. That was his last heroic deed. That's crazy. It takes until July 2001 for the U.S. Navy to officially clear the charges from McVeigh's official record. But the news is great news, and those who are on McVeigh's side are overjoyed. And here's your last little heartwarming bit. In 2005, this would be the 60th anniversary of the sinking of the USS Indianapolis. Commander Hashimoto's daughter and granddaughter joined the event to support the survivors. They're a little uneasy about how well they will be received, but they are received with open arms, and everybody welcomes the women. Together, they all sing God Bless America, demonstrating an unprecedented display of healing and forgiveness. The sinking of the USS Indianapolis is not just, I mean, it is a big, horrible shark attack situation, but it just blew my mind about all the other things that were never discussed previously. Even on Shark Week on Discovery, like, they talk about the sinking of the ship and the men getting attacked by sharks, but the main focus is the sharks. And it's like, wow, this story is horrible at every twist and turn. It is a horrible, horrible story. And finally, there is some resolution at the end. So I am glad to share the little tiny bit of silver lining at the tail end. But it just, I heard this and I was like, wow, I've got to share this with Sustainer Nation. This is nuts. This is absolutely nuts. How have we not heard of these details before? It is now time for your challenge. I challenge you to go watch the movie Jaws. Now that we've had all of this shark talk and it is spring break season, I think it's perfect timing to go see the movie Jaws. The next episode will be April 1st. Just kidding, that's April Fool's Day. Although it is a Monday. And I really could pull it off. The temptation is there. But in all truthfulness, I'll be on spring break the last week of March, burning up PTO that is about to expire. And I would rather stay home and do a whole bunch of chores, and I will also hang out with my kids, and I will enjoy quality time with them. So we shall reconvene on April 8th. Until then, continue saving the world, Sustainer Nation, and I will see you all again on April 8th. Have a great one. Bye.